This programming is sponsored by the UH Health Family Care Center, offering primary care and behavioral health services on the University of Houston campus. Health insurance plans, including Medicare and Medicaid, accepted. New patient appointments and more at 832-UH-CARES.
This programming is sponsored by Linscomb Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at LinscombWealth.com.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Rodinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us at our favorite hangout. Brandon, we are on to 101.
Wow.
This is our 101st episode. We had an awesome time at the Nook last week.
We did.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
If you haven't listened to it, go back and listen to it. It was a lot of fun. Hopefully we'll get to do it again. Jay, this is a big week. I mean, we tend to sort of favor weeks where we can have a few things to talk about so we could really dig in. But this week, there's so much. So let's talk first about 2020. We usually do a roundup. Biden and, you know, sort of his ascendancy tends to be, it seems like, not affected by the allegations of him inappropriately touching people.
I know. So much has happened. We of course, Biden and Huggate or whatever you want to call it. The creepy uncle. Vibe that he's a creepy grandpa, a vibe that he's getting out there and has been chastised for, justifiably so, I would add.
Jay, I share with you the kind of concern about him not taking these allegations seriously, right? He kind of was fairly flippant about it, right? But it also feels like Democrats aren't taking it seriously, right? Because polling still has him atop of the field. We know pre-election polls are noisy, but he's still ahead. How and why?
Well, I think two things. One, we have to recognize that the voting universe in terms of people who actually vote in primaries and general elections in many ways is vastly different than the Twitterverse or the social mediaverse that had been sort of driving a lot of the sort of anti-Biden narrative. I will say this. I think a lot of his general base of support, it's a mile wide and an inch deep. Mm-hmm. He is the known factor. There's still a lot of residual goodwill towards him. I think that's going to carry over. I think when you get to a field of 18, 19 candidates, that's when I think we'll start to see some changes. But with all this, Joe Biden's not even a declared candidate in any way, shape, or form. Eric Swalwell, congressman from California, and Tim Ryan, long-term congressman from the state of Ohio, are running. Swalwell is all about gun-related issues. He's been a staunch supporter of trying to reform our gun laws in a way that prevents sort of mass shootings, et cetera. Tim Ryan is running basically as the moderate, almost conservative Democrat, kind of this Ohio-style Democrat. He's going to wing bat the Midwest,
right,
so he claims. I'll tell you right now, they just don't matter, and we've got 18 candidates and no money. And
well, here's a news alert to all of the people thinking of running, and we're going to see more, no doubt. Just because you're white and you come from America's heartland does not mean that you are going to win back America's, like, you know, middle class, right? That takes a certain amount of finesse, policies. You've got to be able to sort of develop a kind of political connection. That's going to take a lot more than just sort of stepping in and the kind of identity politics that we've seen. So I don't know that that's going to work.
Apparently, Bernie Sanders is a rich, rich man. We now know why for years the guy did not want to release his tax returns. He finally has to. Turns out Bernie, who had been launching almost for a long time, kind of single-handed effort to against millionaires and billionaires on Wall Street, is in fact himself a millionaire.
Right. If he's so rich, how come his shirts are always wrinkled, right? Like, I don't understand. The disconnect is so wide.
He doesn't comb his hair. He wears suits that don't fit him, but he has plenty of Botox in his face.
Right.
Explain that one to me.
Explain that. Well, look, FDR had the same issue, right? I mean, he was as wealthy as you can get, top 1%, even at the time, all the way through the Depression. But, you know, he could be a champion of the people. So it can work. Again, it's going to be about positioning, but I think that there's so much perception here that is bleeding into how the Democrats are considering voting, and Biden's a good example of that. I mean, there are other moderates in the race, right? This week, Amy Klobuchar, it turns out, was what was some people called the sort of police of the kindergarten class, where she would essentially warn families that if their kids didn't come to school, they'd be prosecuted. Kristen Gillibrand, while she was in the House, it turns out, now was essentially backing things like establishing English as an official language of the country. There's a lot of friction, a lot of chaos going on. And I think that, you know, these folks who have got the money like Biden and who've got the reach like Bernie can probably do pretty well.
Well, I think we would be remiss because in the past we've talked about it, but floating above all this has been Mayor Pete, who has been having Pete Buttigieg is having sort of what seems to be a really long 15 minutes. Yeah. The guy's super popular. I will say this, even if you don't like Mayor Pete, if you're on Twitter, go out and follow his husband, because that's the best thing on Twitter right now is Chasten Buttigieg. It's fantastic stuff.
It's funny. He's charming. And I like that he's able to kind of generate this enthusiasm. That can work, right? We'll see once the debates come. That'll really be the kind of cut point, right? Either you're in the $5 million club as of now or you're not. If you're not, you're in real trouble.
Yeah, that's the real cutoff line, right? We know that O'Rourke has money. Harris has money. We know that Sanders obviously has money.
A lot of money, it sounds like.
Yeah, a lot of money. And Warren, I think, is part of that. Notably, we haven't heard anything about money from Booker. We haven't heard anything notable money from Castro and from Gillibrand. I'm not sure they're going to meet that $5 million threshold. Mm-hmm. They're still asking for a dollar on social media right now, Brandon.
It's not good.
Well, Brandon, one of the hottest and biggest items that we came across this week when we were looking at kind of what's out there, one of my all-time favorite people who ever ran for president is Herman Cain.
I mean, hot like a pizza.
Hot like a pizza, like a big pipe and pot. Exactly. Extra cheese on there. And Herman Cain's all about extra cheese. Mr. 999.
The pizza man.
The pizza man. Donald Trump apparently believes he is qualified to be a member of the Federal Reserve.
Herman Cain he's obviously former CEO of Godfather's Pizza. He ran for president during the 2012 campaign, but he faced a lot of allegations about sexual misconduct. I think it's going to hurt him. Clearly, we're not the only ones who think that this is a problem. At least three Republican senators have said that they will not back his nomination. Even Steve Mnuchin, who the Treasury Secretary, said that this is probably not a wise choice. But this is actually an interesting dilemma for Democrats, because you've got here a potential legacy item for the president, right? The Fed board chairs serve 14-year terms. So this is the president essentially stacking the Fed. You've got a long-term effect here, not just for Herman Cain, but also Stephen Moore, who's also up for the same position. He's a conservative editorial writer for the Wall Street Journal. So this is something where you could definitely see like serious longevity for a Trump presidency, but I think that it's going to be knocked down. At least that's my guess.
Yeah, look, you know, I'm. It's fun. We like talking about Herman Cain, but I agree with that. I don't think Herman Cain is going anywhere.
Well, we've been talking about finances, Jay. Tax day is upon us. I'm sorry to say I spent the last weekend like ugly crying and drinking wine paying taxes. So we have a lot of issues surrounding the president's taxes, though, right? So what's going on?
Yeah, we got a couple things here, right? We've got no more free filings you're talking about, right? They're sort of in collusion with the TurboTax people and everyone else.
They seem so nice on all those commercials, right?
I know,
right?
They do, right? And they lie to you, though. they always say you can file for free. And I always, every year, I end up spending like $35.99 or whatever it is, right? So we've got that going on. At the same time, The Congress has asked to see about 9 years or 8 years of the president's taxes, and they are pushing back aggressively. The statute is actually relatively clear that says that the chairman of the House Ways and Means has the ability to do this for a particular reason. The administration has sort of pushed back saying, what's the reason? What's the basis for this? This is going to end up in court. We've had folks that have been highly critical of the president. Mitt Romney, the new senator from Utah, for example, is saying that the Democrats are making a huge mistake going forward on this. It's a bad idea to try to sort of force it that way. And you've got the state of New York that's considering passing a law saying unless you release your taxes, you can't get on the ballot, which will effectively, I think, kind of end some of the problems that the Democrats in the House are doing if that passes. So you've got all that again. So I ask you this question, Brandon. Will we see the president's taxes before the 2020 election?
Well, the chief of staff says we're never going to see them. So I don't think that's true. I think probably they'll leak, at least in some capacity. But I agree with you that this is probably something which may be headed to the Supreme Court. Here's another interesting leverage point, Jay. Now, just this week, we had the president's older sister, who was a federal judge, retire. She retired because there was an investigation into whether or not she had violated judicial conduct rules by participating in fraudulent tax schemes with her siblings. The New York Times, months ago, broke this investigation, which essentially suggested that there were essentially outright fraud in the way that the individual like accounts were set up for the Trump children from President Trump's father.
Right.
So this is basically sort of at a way to dodge taxes and to scheme away from having to pay estate taxes. So this is a serious problem for her, but it also, I think, puts a lot of pressure on the White House to release the taxes, because if she is under these kinds of auspices, then we know that he is too. So that creates potential legal liability for him.
Yeah, no, I think you're 100% right. And I think what the reasoning that is there's an actual linkage between her taxes and his taxes,
yes,
because this is related to their very large inheritance that they received from Fred Trump, their father. So I think all of this comes around. And the interesting thing to me was this was an investigation conducted because she was a member of the federal judiciary. The fact that she resigns from there effectively ends it. Now, the question is whether the federal government will then turn around and try to prosecute her, or the IRS will. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of guessing they won't, because they frankly haven't. And that, lo and behold, the department is run by her brother.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so all this comes about, I think we'll see. But I don't know. I kind of think we are never going to actually see it.
Okay.
And if the fact that we never see it means that we know there's something probably there.
Maybe. Hey, let's talk about happier topics. Baseball is back, Jay. Sorry to say the Cubs are already mathematically eliminated from the playoffs, but at least the Astros are doing well. So we have some interesting, though, connections between baseball and politics, right? In this case, the Trump administration has declared illegal a deal between Major League Baseball and the Cuban Baseball Federation, which would have allowed Cuban athletes to play in the country without having to defect. Essentially, the pattern is that the individuals from other countries have to have sort of a premium surcharge to an organization, which then sort of facilitates their actions and their movement to becoming Major League Baseball players. So this is basically a 25% surcharge. Other countries do it this way. Japan does it that way. So it's not uncommon, but it's certainly expensive. So what do you take from this, Jay?
Yeah, I mean, so essentially what they've done is this, again, we talked about this before. What is the one thing President Trump likes to do? He likes to tear up any agreement that was negotiated by,
yes,
President Obama.
Yes.
This was essentially a deal. Major League Baseball wanted this relationship with the Cuban Baseball Federation, because what was essentially having to happen is that people would have to defect to the United States to be made eligible for the draft and made to be eligible for it to participate in baseball. It also created a circumstance where if you got here quickly, you could just kind of pick the team you wanted to play for, and that created all sorts of other problems. But what they ended up doing with doing this is that the president essentially said, the Cuban Federation is essentially nothing more than an arm of the communist government, and it's sort of a backhanded way of supporting it. They killed it. Major League Baseball has been pushing back, trying to help it. But look, this is an Obama-era rule. And
you said the magic word.
I said the magic word. And just like everything else, this goes bye-bye. So while there's no crying in baseball, there is crying in Cuba, because there's no more baseball, at least there, to come play in the U.S.
At least without a surcharge, right? And that's part of the reason it's expensive for MLB to get these players in, right? So what's older than baseball as the nation's oldest pastime? Making money. So there you go. Money's going to be made, but it's not going to be for MLB, right?
Well, Brandon, shifting gears a little bit, the president was down here in Texas days after a massive fire in Crosby, Texas. The president came down to announce that he's, in fact, deregulating the industry that much more.
I think that's an interesting point. And you know, we have immigration as the kind of front and center issue for a lot of this. But, of course, he was here for the energy issues he was talking about. John Cornyn has distanced himself from Trump on some of these issues, which has been a problem. But George P. Bush may be sucking up to Trump a little bit, right? So you've got essentially there's an uncomfortable moment where President Trump said that George P. Bush was the only good Bush, right? He's the only one who really liked the president, and he gets me, he said. So this was an awkward sort of facilitation of a political endorsement. But I think Trump's here for a good reason, and that is that the Republican vote share has been declining in Texas from a high of about 60% in 2014 to basically 50%, right? So you're talking about a 10-point swing in the course of, you know, only a few cycles. And, you know, Trump could be the first Republican president in a long time to lose Texas, which he does not want. But the counter rally from Julian Castro when Trump was in San Antonio didn't exactly live up to the rally status that he
wanted. Yeah, I think it was a meeting. It was a group meeting, right?
It was,
yeah,
a committee meeting.
So obviously, Julian Castro was trying to get a little play. He's put out, I think, a pretty ambitious immigration plan. Really, kind of the only one that,
yeah,
has done a really comprehensive plan. He and O'Rourke are effectively the only two candidates talking about immigration in any meaningful way. He thought it was going to generate some buzz. Unfortunately for him, it is not, and I think he sort of continues to struggle politically as a result, trying to raise money and give his presidential campaign a boost.
Yeah. Let's talk a little about the legislature, Jay. We're nearing the end. Honestly, it seems like it's flown by. But one thing that has stalled is constitutional carry. Constitutional carry is basically a situation where you can carry a gun any place, any time. You don't have to have any kind of a permit. Sort of by the Constitution, you get to have that right. Activists have been pushing for this for years. They may have taken a step too far this time, Jay. What happened?
Well, you know that old saying, you mess with the bull, you get the horns? Dennis Bonin is a bull. He's the bull of the house. And essentially what happened was a Texas constitutional carry group led by a gentleman with the appropriately named last name of McNutt decided to go to Dennis Bonin's house, knowing that he was not at home, to essentially try to intimidate him into supporting a constitutional carry bill that was put out by Jonathan Stickland. And that bill was essentially bottled up in committee. Bonin reacted, as one might expect, when a guy carrying a semi-automatic shows up at your door when you're not at home. And he essentially
his kids and his wife was at home.
Yes, his child was home ill. His wife was home angrily and essentially said, constitutional carry is dead for this session. Even made the situation even worse. Someone at an event decided to put McNutt and Bonin essentially sitting back to back. Words were exchanged, as you might expect. Constitutional carry may never happen as long as Dennis Bonin is Speaker of the Texas House.
Well, like you say, don't mess with the bull, right? I think it was dead anyway. This is just bad politics. And it was an unconscionable intimidation tactic. It needs to stop. There was no Senate companion to the bill anyway. It wasn't going to go anywhere. And honestly, I think the issues would have been saturated, right? You had open carry in 2015. You had campus carry in 2017. The issue, I think, has really reached a saturation point. And in addition, you're talking about this on the back of tragedies in Sutherland Springs and Santa Fe High School. It was dead long before this happened, but this is just unacceptable and clearly a step out of bounds.
Well, Brandon, the Texas Senate recently approved a set of exemptions. We've talked about in the past, religious liberty exemptions has been sort of the new catch-all nationally, in many, particularly in the South, in many legislatures, for occupational licenses. Tell us a little bit about this and why folks in the LGBTQ community are in particular very upset.
Yeah, so this was introduced by Lubbock Republican Charles Perry, the Senate. This essentially allows for people who hold occupational licenses as given by the state, like social workers or lawyers, to cite sincerely held religious beliefs. I'm doing air quotes with their licenses. Essentially, that protects their ability to sort of say what they think and not have to follow through with particular kinds of obligations. A lot of people have pushed back on this. In fact, in the Senate, in the hearings, many of the members called this essentially a license to discriminate. The similar fault lines here to the bathroom bill, right? You've got business organizations which are against it. Democrats are clearly against it. Interesting wrinkle here, though. One Democrat was not. Senator Andy Lucio, who is going to get the most severe primary challenge. He's from the Valley. He voted for it. And Kel Seliger, Republican from Amarillo and Lubbock areas, he voted against it. So there's an interesting sort of dynamic in terms of business versus sort of that arch conservativeness. It's not going to pass the House, period. But it's a win for conservatives, at least, to get it through the House or Senate, rather.
I mean, that's the whole thing, right? I mean, and some of these things are just symbolic in nature. We saw a similar effect on an abortion-related bill that essentially died as a result. They are sticking to the script. And part of that script, it's been three things, right? It's been property taxes, it's been school finance, and it's been sort of Harvey relief. That's been the big three. Mm-hmm. On the taxes and on school, we got a huge major announcement from the governor, lieutenant governor, and speaker proposing this sort of tax increase and swap out mm-hmm. of property taxes. They want to increase taxes for the sales tax by 1 cent and reduce about $1 billion in property taxes.
Yeah, it's going to require, though, 2/3 of both the House and the Senate and voter approval. That's a lot. Asking voters to raise taxes is not very popular. But what's interesting to me about this is it's like Avengers Infinity War. You've got these unusual like groupings of alliances that you wouldn't expect going in, right? So you have Republicans who are saying, don't raise taxes. That's not surprising. But you've also got Democrats saying, don't raise the sales tax because it's regressive. It's going to hurt people who have less income. So it's an interesting dynamic here. The polling suggests this is really unpopular, right? In terms of sort of funding public ed, people would rather have taxes on marijuana or alcoholic beverages and should not do things like increase the motor fuels tax or sales tax. Also, I think things like selling the Panhandle to Oklahoma or eating vinegar with barbecue sauce or going to a Toby Keith concert, all things that the Texans would not approve of in terms of raising revenue for public ed. So I think this is probably going to be a real problem, so I don't think it's going to go anywhere. But they have to do something about property taxes. That's a number one issue.
Well, the problem here, of course, is what they don't want to do. I'm talking these three, is they don't want to close some of the corporate loopholes. Because what we know now is that residential property taxpayers essentially subsidize a lot of the corporations that own that are able to negotiate and reduce some of the property values. And that's what the big driver is. The issue in Texas on property taxes is not the property tax rate. It is the valuation of the property that essentially automatically goes up. Mm-hmm. And that's been the big issue here, and that's been the big divider. Well, Brandon, if you ever thought the state of Texas was a battleground state, you have gotten that view confirmed in spades. The U.S. House Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee has opened up a Texas office. That is the official designation that the state is a battleground state.
Yeah, they're finally putting their money where their mouth is. We haven't seen this kind of investment since the 90s. This is actually the Orange County model. Now, I work politics in both Orange County and here in Texas. And the one thing that can really make the difference is that kind of knuckle herding, door knocking, voter energy, and candidate recruitment. Those are the things that really move the needle. Think about this. If the Democrats can flip three seats, as they might be able to, of the seats six they're targeting, you're talking about essentially the delegation being a majority Democrat instead of Republican, right? Going from 24 Republicans in 2016 to 21 Democrats in 2020. That's big. There are these districts in this case that are underwater. Trump is not popular in 21 and in 22 and also in 31. So these are flippable districts.
Right. And then there was recent polling in 10 that shows him underwater in 10 as well. Wow. So you've got a bunch of issues there. 22, same thing down here in Fort Bend County. So yep. You've got a lot of issues going on. So it's no surprise that you're starting to see sort of people come out of the woodwork to run. We've talked a little bit about the U.S. Senate race, but in CD21, the one that Chip Roy currently won mm-hmm. and held, he had a very close race that people didn't see, although we did, from yeah. Joseph Kopser, who's a tech millionaire, a Navy veteran, but a very famous name, at least by some standards, Wendy Davis, former state senator, former Democratic nominee for governor, is talking about running in CD21. This is the Austin, San Antonio, San Marcos kind of sprawl district.
Yeah, famous or infamous, right? Wendy Davis obviously became sort of very notable for her filibuster on a big abortion bill a couple of sessions ago. She's not the perfect candidate for this district. It's a Republican-leaning district, and abortion is a hard issue for Democrats to win on. But the polling actually, I think, may be successful for her. It was a close district. It's a plus 18 Democratic district since 2016. A lot of that vote came from Travis County, where you've got a lot more Democrats. It was pretty flat in Bexar County. So if she can count on a big boost of a Republican decline and an increase in Democratic votes in a presidential election year, that would work. Also, it skews much younger and much more college educated. So that's her crowd. So this could be a seat they pick up.
Yeah, I think they'd be smarter off just letting Kopser run again. I mean, she's
well,
a good candidate.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. I think they'd be better off doing that and saving, I think, Wendy for a different seat. She might make some degree of sense of running in Tarrant County again, although she lives in Austin now.
Well, Jay, we've had some other big sports news this week. Congratulations to the Texas Tech Red Raiders that got to the finals of March Madness of the NCAA tournament. But they may have been jinxed, Jay, by a homegrown senator. What happened?
That's right. The Zodiac Killer strikes again. Of course, we're talking about the junior senator from Texas, Ted Cruz, with about, I don't know, less than a minute to go. Tech was up by one. They saw it had victory in sights. Ted Cruz decided to take a selfie in the arena. And the rest, of course, is history. Goes into overtime, and then they end up losing. I'm going to blame the loss entirely on Ted Cruz.
I'm going to say 50-50, Ted Cruz and bad defense, right? But Cruz has done this to us before, right? Remember Game 7 of the Rockets-Warriors game, right? He tweeted out that, you know, go Rockets, and then they missed 27 straight threes. Like, just yeah. Stop tweeting, Ted Cruz. Stop tweeting.
Yes. All politicians, do not tweet until the game is over.
Hold your breath. Cross your fingers. That's it.
All right. Well, Brandon, the big news of the week, of course, has been a massive shakeup in the Department of Homeland Security. Kirstjen Nielsen, who was the second director succeeding John Kelly, was asked to resign, I think is a nice way of putting it, okay. Essentially for not being, I think, strong enough to mm-hmm. use Trump's terminology, mm-hmm. as others would say, not cruel enough down in terms of Homeland Security. It's created upheaval. The head of the Secret Service is also going out or retiring. Big shakeup there. We've got a lot of problems. The federal judge has blocked the president on the changes he wants to make on asylum. The president announced he wants to cut aid, all aid to three Central American countries that are the primary source of the asylees that are coming here, Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. Lots going on. What do we make of all of this?
And the country is full, apparently, according to Trump.
Yes.
We're full up.
We're full up. No more.
Why is the house next door to me not sell then? Like, we, you know, there's plenty of room, right? Well, I think the problem for Trump is that it's not so much that it's personnel. It's about planning, right? They need new leadership, but more importantly, they need some kind of agenda. And I think they don't have it. They're flipping and flopping. Like you say, there are issues about whether or not we should close the border, right? They got pushback on that, cutting aid to Central America. They got pushback on that. These aren't real plans, right? These are just kind of political positions. And they're trying to work on a bipartisan deal. Kushner is at the sort of current moment that they're trying to get some kind of buy-in, but no one's buying, right? Democrats are essentially selling, right? They're waiting on the sidelines to like allow the president of the administration to just make unforced errors and like let them knock themselves out. That's not a good political strategy.
Yeah, the interesting thing is that most of the moderating influences on the president when it comes to immigration are effectively gone, right? John Kelly is gone. Most of the military folks are gone. And we've essentially been left with policy that's largely driven by Stephen Miller. Chris Kobach from Kansas has been a big proponent of a lot of the things that the president talked about. So a lot of the moderating influences are gone. And effectively, all you're left with is hoping for Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump to essentially persuade the president off this sort of seeming cliff.
And Republicans are abandoning ship, right? Chuck Grassley says, that, you know, don't oust any more people. John Cornyn said it's a mess over there. It's not working. All these acting secretaries, Jay, I think is going to take its toll, right? You've got interim secretaries in defense, interior, OMB, small business, at the UN, even the president's chief of staff. We've got a government of Quiznos employees, right? This undercuts accountability. It minimizes the role of the Senate. And I think that this is why we can't have long-term planning. The reason they don't have a plan is because they don't have people to sit and plan it.
Yeah, it's government by temp workers right now, right? Yeah. I mean, that's essentially what you have. You can't create any sort of larger cohesive policy. And I think it's a real problem. I think the fundamental issue is that the president looks at everything, at least in this context, from a political base view. He sees immigration as sort of his touchstone issue. It's the primary issue for him. And as a consequence, it's going to drive, I think, the presidential campaign. That's one of the reasons why I think you and I have talked about this is that Democrats are missing an opportunity. There's been a lot written about the fact that we know where the president is on immigration. We know what he wants. It's much, much harder to figure out where Democrats are, particularly Democrats on in, not just in the House and the Senate, but the candidates, with the exception of two candidates. They're the O'Rourke and Castro are the only ones who sort of get the immigration issue.
Yeah. So it's going to be a boon for them.
And I think so. But the issue is sort of how you get there. So I think there's a lot of moving pieces here. The strategy from a purely policy perspective, cutting off aid to the countries that are essentially that are supplying most of the folks who are coming over here, it's actually just a dumb thing to do. Everyone has essentially told him this. So it's counterintuitive. It doesn't make any sense, but they're doing it. But I'm not quite sure what the end game is for them.
Well, the president says that the Secretary Nielsen was not being tough enough, right? So he wants to move in a tougher direction, but they can't, right? Legally, she was like, there are so many roadblocks in terms of what the president wants to do. They're already being pretty tough. They need to either let it work and see if it does, or take a new strategy, right? But they can't do both.
Yeah, I mean, I think the notion, even when you look at some of the polling data, the notion that the policy that the Trump administration has done wasn't tough enough, I think is just something that's not borne out by the way people perceive it. I think it's viewed as tough as you possibly could get. And if anything, people, I think, generally want to kind of pull back on some of that.
It's all about the base, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that a song, right?
Yeah.
All about the base.
Yeah,
right?
All about the base. Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Big thanks to our ever-patient producer, Sophie Moll. Special kudos to our web and graphics team here at Houston Public Media. And finally, thanks to our great audio engineer, Todd, the acting Secretary of Audio, Paul Slender.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. We'll see you next week.